The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. I hope you're enjoying the program wherever you're bunkered down at the moment. It is, what, week three or four of our lockdown, and I'm going a little stir crazy with the kids, I have to be honest. But I'm here now in the sanctuary of this podcast, so I'm very grateful for it. All of your comments from last week will be read out at the end of the show. But coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the science of ASMR. What exactly is it and what does it do to the body? If you're an ASMR fan, we'll be speaking to Julia Poerio, who has been researching ASMR and trying to figure out why people have such a physical reaction to the sounds of people folding towels and whispering into microphones. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio are Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan, doctor and immunologist. You're both very welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you, Johnny?
Not too bad. I mean, I'm seeing these comments on Twitter where people are saying, oh, I'm learning new baking bread recipes, and oh, I think I'll take up online poker. Like, I don't know where everyone's finding the spare time from, but that is not my experience. I suppose that's not necessarily a bad thing. And there are other things going on in the world, of course. But everything's relative,
but right. You're a busy bee anyway.
Yeah, I am. Shane, how are you?
I'm not too bad. I think the world is broken up into those who have children and thus are doing an enormous amount of work. And then the rest of us who are sort of like, kind of just, you know, it's a bit meh.
You're learning Japanese, are you? Stuff.
Yeah, I'm learning Japanese. I'm learning the flute, and okay. I've taken up bonsai tree gardening.
Okay, moving on.
I haven't really. I've just been watching Netflix. Ah.
Okay, well, if you could do that, that would make me feel a lot better about the time I don't have. All right, our first story.
You understood what I've just said to you?
Yes. Lung cancer. It's just, you've got mustard on your...
I dig it. Mustard. There, right there,
is not about COVID-19 for the first time in 3 weeks, Lara. It's a good news story about cancer.
Yes, it most certainly is. This, I think, is a really interesting story. It's come out of Harvard Medical School. And I suppose one of the ways to frame it is that a lot of people would have heard of prenatal testing. So when you're pregnant, you can give a sample of your blood and they can use that blood to look at the baby's blood to see if there's any fetal abnormalities. And it's a brilliant way of testing the baby for any problems without harming it in any way. And it's the same concept for this new test to look for cancer. So what they're doing is they're taking blood samples, and they took them from Dr. Jeffrey Oxnard is the name of the key researcher. And they're taking blood samples from thousands of people, and approximately half of these people have been diagnosed with cancer and they know what type it is, and approximately half haven't. So it's a huge wealth of people who are donating their blood for this research. And what they're doing is they're looking at DNA methylation. We've talked about this a lot in the show before, but rather than it being the actual sequence of the DNA, it's the little bits of information sitting on top of that sequence. And they're mining this blood sample or these blood samples to see whether or not these people have cancer. So they're feeding all the information into a huge AI system. And this machine learning algorithm is able to know, obviously, for the ones that have cancer, they tell them they have cancer. For the ones that don't, they tell them they don't. And they've done this for thousands of patients. And now they're finding that they're getting really interesting results. I suppose the thing is, for me, this will be the gold standard in the future. I think it's the most phenomenal way to do it. It's non-invasive, but at the moment, it's not there yet. This research is really good in showing up no false positives. So they're not telling anyone who doesn't have cancer that they have cancer. It's less than 1%, but it only shows up 44% of the people who do have cancer. So that is an absolutely unacceptable false negative rate. And you could never, ever use this currently in its absolute form for testing. But what's really fascinating, and it makes a lot of sense, is that if you have a stage one cancer, it's only identifying it in 18% of people. But if you have a stage four, it's identifying 93% of people, and it's identifying the correct cancer. So in 96% of cases, it knew what the cancer was. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. So, you know, it's a fast, it's an easy test, it's non-invasive. It just needs to get better. I mean, if you think about it, stage one cancer, it's like having a very, very early fetus almost. And that's why you can't do these prenatal tests on, you know, a fetus that's only 5-6 weeks old. There's not enough sample there. Whereas a stage four cancer, I shouldn't be comparing them to fetus. Maybe it's because I have a 6 week old baby at home. I'm comparing cancer to babies. But, you know, there's a lot more DNA there for a later stage cancer. So but, it makes sense that it would be identified.
Am I right in saying it's pretty useless being able to tell when someone has stage four cancer, because presumably the patient themselves would be fully aware of that?
Vast, vast majority of the time, someone is going to know they have stage four cancer. Sometimes for things like ovarian cancer, it's still hidden. And, you know, maybe it would help. But you're right, to be honest, at that stage, most of the time, you could get a quick CT scan and people are going to know straight away. So they really need to refine, you know, if they can come up with a way of multiplying up the small amounts of DNA that are in the early stage cancer, that would be the real key, I think. But you're dead right. The early stage is where it's at, and they need to refine that.
Yeah, that does sound like what Elizabeth Holmes did with the company Theranos. I don't know if you've read the book Bad Blood, but it is a riveting read about someone who was trying to get more out of a small sample and things going horribly wrong in Silicon Valley. Shane, our second story has to do with another surprisingly good prediction. If we behave, that we could actually restore our oceans in just 3 decades?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a review article. So it's looking at published work already and sort of making conclusions from looking at a number of different publications. And it's saying that if we are able to change our behavior when it comes to how we treat our oceans, that we could restore the ocean within 30 years, which is not that long a period of time. So like we really have been abusing our ocean through overfishing, pollution, coastal destruction, acidification when we think of climate change. And this review has looked at good news stories where local conservation has turned things around and improved things for marine wildlife and the plant life that lives in the ocean. And it's shown that remarkably things can return to their former glory in a short period of time. The caveat here, however, is that we have a window in which to act. And if I'm taking anything from the current acute crisis, is that we can work together across the world to solve issues that affect us. And of course, COVID-19 is very important.
If they're more than 5 days away.
Well, this is what I need to think more about. I think we all do. It's like, why is it that we are able to correctly respond, throw everything at something that's 5 days away? But yet, if we say it's 5 decades away, it's like, no, it's not a problem. Don't care. The economy is more important. Why is it that there's such a difference? It's the analogy of sort of dropping the frog into the boiling water versus putting a frog into the water and heating it up slowly. And the frog knows in one scenario it's bad, and then the other one going, no, it's just a little bit warmer than it was a second ago. I'm okay.
I think that's been debunked as an idea. I think the frog gets the hell out of the pan when it gets hot. I think I read that recently.
I don't know enough about frogs to argue with you.
Listen, this is not a philosophy show anyway. This is a science show. What does the science say?
Well, physics was always called natural philosophy. So we did think in a philosophical way about these problems. But they have pointed to in this review the stories of things like humpback whales, which in the 1960s, there were only hundreds of these creatures left. And through careful and considered conservation, we're now up to populations of around 40,000. So in this review, they point to lots of good news stories as a way to encourage people to take conservation and sustainability seriously when it comes to our oceans.
What about the coral reefs, though, right? That's unreversible, I thought. The blanching of the coral reefs, particularly in Australia?
Yes, so that sort of stuff does take time, of course, absolutely. But the paper suggests that the ocean can restore itself to a significant degree within 30 years. So they don't say anything in particular about coral reefs, but they're talking about the rest of marine wildlife that's in there. It is positive.
Well, look, I mean, we've got to take what we can in the current crisis, right? And the idea that... you know, everything is irreversible at this stage is something that has been sort of talked about. Good to know that if we were suddenly to have a change of heart about what it means to be a human in the natural world, we could actually rescue the world's oceans, because that's quite a large part of our planet. Our third story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Fintan O'Toole recently wrote a fantastic article where he talked about the fact that we now realize we're all human and we're creatures, and that we don't have this sense of being a master race, that we can just control the earth as we see fit. I think we're experiencing the fact at the moment that we all are creatures and are susceptible. And if we don't look after where we live and look after each other, things can happen.
Our third story has to do with AI, Lara, and a rather dubious claim in a headline that computers are now being able to read speech that is just thought in the brain.
Yeah, I love headlines. I mean, they have to write headlines to make you read the stories. But fortunately, most of the time, these dramatic headlines hide quite interesting and really good research underneath. And what they've done in this story, which was published in Nature Neuroscience, which came from the University of California, is they took four patients who already have electrode arrays implanted in their brain. So some people who have very bad intractable epilepsy need to have electrodes implanted into their brains to help prevent seizures. So these people become this wealth of possible research, because who has electrodes already implanted in their brains? It's phenomenal. So these four people volunteered to do this study. And what they did was they had them read out aloud 50 different sentences. So including things like Tina Turner is a pop singer and those thieves stole 30 jewels.
You can tell the PI was quite old if he's referencing Tina Turner.
I know. I was wondering why. I presume it includes all the different sounds, but I love the Tina Turner reference. So what they did was they had the electrodes assess the exact types of electrical activity that were coming out of the brain as they said the sentences. And they fed it into a deep learning AI, which was able to break it down into numbers and then reconstruct it as sentences. Now, obviously, they had to tell the AI what the sentences were. But then they could have the people, these same people, read out the sentences again. And the AI was actually surprisingly good at telling what the sentence was going to be. For example, for one of the four participants, it only got the sentence wrong 3% of the time, which wow. I think is pretty phenomenal. I mean, if humans are transcribing from, say, a recorded tape, they get it wrong 5% of the time. So that's actually a bit better. But some of the times it did get it wrong. So one of the sentences was, those musicians harmonize marvelously, and the machine read, the spinach was a famous singer. And another sentence was, a roll of wire lay near the wall, and the machine decided that they said, will Robin wear a yellow lily? So some of them were completely inaccurate. I suppose there's a bunch of caveats here. Obviously, the first one is that most people will not have brains with implanted devices in them. And the reason to do all of this is to help people with things like locked-in syndrome. So people who can't speak, because if you can already speak, why do you need a machine to say what you're saying? So this works on the brain responses of spoken word. And that is the big caveat here. This is not done on thought word. It's done on spoken word.
Right.
And, you know, if you have that, why can't you just ask Alexa or Siri to do whatever you need to do, because you can speak already? So they need to refine it to correspond with the thought word rather than the spoken word. But I mean, it's still really good basic research.
And I guess the idea might be that they might be able to read from the brain patterns that are activated when you think about physically mouthing the word as opposed to thinking it. Is that generally the idea?
And that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, it's not about your deep thought or your inner thought. It's about having the thought process to make the speech. And that's what they're hoping to be able to do. But I mean, it's hugely invasive to implant these things into people with locked-in syndrome, and they obviously can't consent. So there's a lot of problems in this. But it's still, I do think it's very interesting as a basic research.
And our final story, Shane, shows us that physicists should probably stay away from emergency medicine.
Yeah, we really should stay at home. So this is about an astrophysicist. I should stress he's an astrophysicist who's 27.
Are you distancing yourself within physics? You never did that before.
Because,
you never did that before, just saying.
No, maybe I should back out of this. I was going to say this guy's a theorist, so he works on pulsars and gravitational waves. And basically what he did was he built a device that would send out an alarm if he was going to touch his face. And to do that, he built a simple circuit, and he took some really powerful neodymium magnets. And knowing that when the magnets were going to come in contact with or in close proximity to the circuit, that there was going to be an alarm sent off, that this would warn him to stop touching his face. And he says himself that, like, you know, I had some basic electronic equipment, but I didn't have any experience or expertise with circuits. And so he decided to build the device, but it completely did not work because the alarm went off continuously unless he brought the magnets close to his circuit. So it was a reverse alarm. So he decided to abandon his idea. And then, like any good scientist, he started to play. And he decided to use the magnets and make an earring. So he stuck the magnets to his ear, one side with one magnet and the other side of the ear with the other. And he did something similar with his nose. And of course, one thing led to another, and he ended up with magnets up his nostril. And so at this point, his partner, who works in the hospital, suggested that he was an idiot and said, what are you going to do? So being a good physicist, he Googled it and he found that an 11-year-old online had had the a similar issue and decided that the best course of action was to use even more magnets to try and pull Yeah, so he made the bad situation worse. His last attempt was to use a pliers. Of course, neodymium magnets are so strong that they actually magnetize the pliers. And so it also made the situation worse. So he got himself into hospital. And I can only imagine what they'd say in A&E now if you arrived in at the moment with this sort of a scenario.
Of course, doctors and a dangle of specialist astrophysics magnets.
Exactly. So, like, of course, they treat him, but they had to anesthetize the area, and they got most of the magnets out. One decided to go down his throat as they were taking it out, but luckily he was able to cough it up just in time. I don't think it's the sort of thing you'd want to swallow. And he did get sent home, and he, I don't know whether it was a very wise idea or not, he decided to talk to the nice people at The Guardian to tell them his story. What I like about this story is that it shows, like, you know, the way we hear, oh, so many science things have been discovered by accident. And yes, they have. But most of the science experiments that go on, or the playing that scientists do, ends in some sort of failure. And this guy, he failed spectacularly.
It's a pretty good failure. And at least gave us something to smile about that's COVID related. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Laura Dungan, as always, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Welcome back to Future Proof. I'm Jonathan McRae. I'm so happy you decided to join me in my shed. No, I haven't lost my voice or had a stroke. I'm trying to elicit ASMR in you. You see, every day YouTube sees around 500 new ASMR videos uploaded, and the top 5 ASMR channels have nearly 2 billion views. So maybe we should have a quick listen to one of them to see what we're about to talk about. Have a listen to this.
I'll just try to help you sleep by massaging the inner parts of your head.
So what the hell was that? And what is ASMR? Well, Dr. Julia Poerio is a lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex and one of the co-authors on a new paper examining the physiological effects of ASMR. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Julia. What is ASMR?
So ASMR is a term that stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. It's quite a pseudoscientific term, really. But it's a term used to describe a particular kind of feeling that only some people experience. The feeling itself can be likened to fizzing bubbles on the top of your head. It's almost like a tingly sort of massage that you might get. Starts at the top of the head and can spread throughout the rest of the body. And what's interesting is that this kind of sort of goose tingly response is triggered by certain things, including whispering, soft speaking, tapping, close personal attention. So a lot of people who are able to experience ASMR, which is quite a complex emotion, say that they have experienced it since childhood. So common early examples include getting your, you know, hair checked for lice at school, or maybe your shoes fitted in a shop, or going to the doctor or the dentist and things like that. So it's a very kind of common experience for a lot of people, and hopefully your listeners might relate to it as well.
There is a sort of a head massage thing you can pick up often in flea markets, and it's sort of a claw on sort of wires, and you kind of push it down over your head and it kind of spreads out over your scalp. And that's sort of the sensation I imagine people are getting when they experience ASMR.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those things I think are called orgasmatrons.
Are they? I wasn't delicately avoiding the title. I just didn't know that. Orgasmatrons, right.
I have a vibrating one that I use to kind of demonstrate the feeling to people because it is like that. But what's really interesting is that you can basically get the feeling of touch, of massage, head massage, without actually being touched, which is really cool from a psychology perspective because it's, you know, it's like, well, how is it that this information that we're getting from one modality, like what we're seeing and what we're hearing, how are we integrating that from our senses to elicit a feeling of touch and intense emotional experience? So that's pretty interesting from a psychology perspective.
I mean, it is, absolutely. And it is very zeitgeisty as well. I mean, there's a huge amount of content on the internet and people have become ASMR stars just from developing content that makes people feel this way. It's strange then, I suppose, that there's so little scientific literature on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that strange because the term was only, you know, it's now been a decade since the term was coined. And I think science quite often is a bit slower to catch up with public interest. Mm. So it's not all that surprising. Science is quite slow anyway in terms of having to do research and get published. It can take, you know, quite a few years. So our paper that was published in 2018, we actually started working on that in 2014. So that just gives you a bit of an idea of how much longer science takes. It's not immediate. I think interest is growing, and a lot of that has got to do with basically legitimacy for ASMR. So I think a lot of people, especially if they don't experience it, maybe find it really difficult to believe. So they think, oh, no, this is either really weird or creepy or somehow sexual, and it's not a genuine experience. And I think that comes from the fact that people quite often find it really difficult to believe things that they don't experience themselves. Mm. And so trying to overcome that kind of barrier, it can be quite difficult.
Yeah, and I suppose I definitely know it's a thing, and I get that it's not sexual, and I think that's an important thing to point out, that this isn't a sexy thing, although whispering for some reason was seen as, I don't know how whispering got sexualized, but it has, and they're two separate things, right? I mean, ASMR is not a sexy thing for most people. It's a sensational thing, but not a sexy thing.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So, I mean, we've asked people this in our research as well. So we've asked people whether they feel sexually aroused from the videos, and there's no evidence to suggest that ASMR itself is a sexual feeling. And I think it's important at this point to distinguish between ASMR as a feeling, in the same way that happiness is a feeling, and ASMR videos. And ASMR videos are intended to induce that feeling, but that's not to say that they couldn't induce, you know, other feelings as well. But the videos are different from the feeling itself. And I think a lot of people equate those two things as being the same. But ASMR existed as a feeling before YouTube.
So you wanted to study this and just get to the bottom of why this has been so popular and what was going on inside the body. So you did two studies. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so the first one was a large online survey that we did, and we showed people a range of videos. We showed them ASMR videos that involved speaking, so vocal sounds, and ASMR videos that just included sounds that weren't vocal, so things like tapping, scratching, crinkling, those sorts of things. And we also showed people a range of videos that were not ASMR videos, but they contained certain characteristics of those videos, like demonstrating something. Mm. And then we asked people about their feelings after watching the videos, and we compared people who say that they experience ASMR to people who say that they don't experience ASMR in terms of their self-reported emotional responses. And what we found was that people who experience ASMR show significant increases in feelings of relaxation and calmness. And this was really kind of the first kind of scientific or, you know, reliable evidence that there is this consistent response to ASMR videos, but not these control videos. So another thing that was really interesting was that on average, people who experience ASMR experience greater ASMR from the whispering and from the vocal sounds than from the non-vocal ones. So that's another interesting thing that we found from our first study. And that was really just to kind of lay the groundwork for the second study we did, which was looking at the physiology. So what's going on in the body.
Absolutely. And I think the people who listen to this program quite a bit might say, you know, that that first study, there's some potential experimental problems with it in really getting a scientific read on it, because it's self-reporting, because you've got a self-selecting group who are saying they're ASMR listeners. But you need to do that sort of exploratory work to start and see, okay, what's the next level to really get under the hood of it. And I think that first study really sort of gave you a really good sense that this is something where it's definitely worth digging deeper.
Yeah, and I think as well that first study allowed us to look at lots of different videos of ASMR and pick ones for future research that we know are very good at eliciting ASMR in responders. So that was another useful aspect of the first study, was that we kind of, it allowed us to narrow down our kind of stimulus material.
So talk to us about the second study then.
So the second study was really interesting from our perspective, because we brought people into the lab and we asked them to watch ASMR videos. One of them was self-selected, so they picked their own particular kind of ASMR video that they thought would trigger the ASMR. Another one was what we called the standard ASMR video. So this was the video from study one that had elicited the strongest ASMR response. And the third study was our control video, which out of the control videos from study one was the most neutral. So it didn't elicit very much emotion at all. And we got 50 people who experienced ASMR, and then we got 50 gender and age matched controls to take part in a study where they watched these videos whilst we measured their physiological responses. So we measured a range of things, including heart rate, which is quite self-explanatory, but also skin conductance response, which is essentially a measure of the sweating of your skin, which is a measure of kind of arousal, physiological arousal. So if you think about, if you get, you know, excited or anxious, you might sweat. That's essentially what it's measuring. Mm. Yeah. We also asked people the same questions as we did in study one, so asked them about their emotional responses, and we essentially replicated that same effect. So people who experience ASMR, they showed greater feelings of relaxation and calmness, and also feelings of excitement, actually, compared to those who don't experience ASMR. And then what was really interesting was the physiological differences. So people who experience ASMR, when they watch ASMR videos, they show significant reductions in their heart rate, but also significant increases in their skin conductance response. And we think that this might be related to the kind of complex emotional nature of ASMR. So it might seem counterintuitive that it's both sort of arousing and a relaxing sensation, but this does relate to what people describe ASMR as, a kind of a euphoric relaxation. And what we wonder, which we're trying to replicate at the moment, we're trying to see, is whether the increase in skin conductance is what's happening when people are experiencing the tingles, and the decreased heart rate is what's happening overall. So I think it's important for people to realize that ASMR isn't just this constant experience. It comes in ebbs and flows and waves. So the tingles don't last for like the whole 3 minutes that you're watching a video. They kind of ebb and flow.
What was the most popular video that you said? What was the one that elicited the most ASMR response? Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, so from the ones that we selected, it was a towel folding video of Maria Gentle whispering. So she is giving you a tutorial on how to best fold towels. And so this involves her whispering and speaking quite softly, and also very delicate hand movements where she's sectioning the towel into three segments, and then she's folding. So she's kind of pressing her fingers along the kind of edges of the towel, and it's all very delicate and very well controlled. So it might seem like really mundane to a lot of people, but for others, this is a really relaxing experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Twitter account called Extremely Satisfying, and it just has videos of things working out just perfectly. And sometimes it's manufacturing, and sometimes it's paint, or sometimes it's just a series of actions that ends in something just working exactly the way it should.
Yeah.
And they're really satisfying, but I don't get that sort of arousal that you're you're talking about, that people get from ASMR. So why do you think we have that? Have we got evolutionary psychologists on top of this one yet?
So, I mean, I think some people would say that it's maybe related to kind of grooming behaviors and things like that.
Like formerly our ancestors picked nits out of our hair.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't I mean, I don't know how much I believe that. I mean, it's an interesting possibility. As you know, I think what really is probably going on is that ASMR represents differences in the way that we integrate information from our external world and process that information to give rise to emotional experiences. And that's why, you know, this is a quite an interesting question in psychology of why actually, you know, the external world isn't this objective thing. Because we all have our own kind of lenses that we see things through, and we have our own previous experience, and our brains are wired and connected in different ways that mean that we experience subjectively very different things.
What goes on in the brains? Have we done fMRI to see blood flow in the brain and whether or not people listening to these videos have different blood flow or the different things going on in their brain when they experience ASMR?
Yeah, so there's been one study that was published in 2018, and they asked 10 people who experienced ASMR to watch ASMR videos in the scanner. And what they did was they compared the sections of where they experienced tingling, so the ASMR tingling, to other sections of the video. And they found increases in activation in quite a lot of areas of the brain involved in emotion, reward processing, and what they call affiliative behaviors. So that doesn't tell us anything about causality, though. That is just essentially that's correlational. So that's just, you know, this is what is co-occurring in the brain. It doesn't mean that the brain is doing ASMR.
And is there anything that separates the two groups, people who experience ASMR and not? Did you do either a personality test or a physiology test? Is there anything that separates them?
Yeah, so there's been a fair few kind of attempts to try and understand what distinguishes people who experience from those that don't. There's some suggestion that people with ASMR score higher on personality traits of openness to experience, and also that they're more empathetic, at least on some measures of empathy. I think we've got to be quite
careful.
Yeah, so I think we do have to be quite careful because there are self-selection biases. And I think particularly with sort of control groups, non-ASMR groups, I think you get a very skewed sample of people who will take a survey that they're not massively interested in. So people who experience ASMR want to contribute to the research. So they're more likely to take a survey that's not offering reward, whereas people who are doing it who don't experience ASMR, you might attract certain kinds of people. So probably people who are quite pro-social, who are nice and are willing to give up their time to help science.
Yeah. I just want to know before we go, where is this research going? Are we likely to uncover something useful from ASMR? Could it be used in therapy for that? What's the percentage? 5% or so that experience ASMR?
So we don't know the percentage. We haven't got a population estimate.
Right.
I think one of the things that we found interesting from our research was that even if you don't experience ASMR, you might get some benefit from watching these videos. So they might still provide some sort of benefit. So we are looking at the potential benefits of ASMR and potentially ways of enhancing the ASMR experience so people can gain benefit. You only have to look at, you know, comments on YouTube to know that people are already using these videos and it's helping them a tremendous amount. We're also very interested in understanding why this happens as a way to understanding, you know, how emotions are generated, which is, you know, very interesting from a psychological perspective. But yeah, we're doing lots of interesting things at the moment. And one of the things that we're trying to do is set up a research network for ASMR so that we can all kind of collaborate and share resources and ideas and come up with an agenda to try and drive this research forward at a much faster pace than it's been currently happening. So there's lots on the horizon.
I mean, if people can feel a sense of calmness, a sense of deep relaxation and not have to do mindfulness, I know people who love mindfulness and there is good science behind it will kill me, but it's a hard thing sometimes to do, to keep refocusing your mind. This is just, you know, you watch someone doing something, you get that sense, that you get that benefit of feeling calm and less anxious. I think it's a fantastic thing. Really interesting speaking with you, Dr. Julia Poerio, lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay. Cheers.
Cheers. All right, it's time to look back at your texts and tweets from last week. And Stephen got in touch. He said, I think it would be interesting to have a specialist in bats and the diseases that they carry, including COVID-19 and MERS. I also understand that mosquitoes are being bred without malaria. Have any bats been bred without particular diseases? Well, we have a resident expert, Dr. Emma Teeling, who we'll put that question to Stephen. But yeah, we might talk about species jump, and if we can dig it out, the Futureproof Gold podcast will feature the species jump interview we did a few months back. And Niall from Wicklow has been in touch. He said, Jonathan, just to let you know, love the show, particularly the podcast. Have been listening for the past 2 years. Love the physics pieces in particular. Shane will be delighted with that. Had a great science teacher in Nina called Timmy Brophy, who was way ahead of his time and gave us a love of all things in the universe. Keep up the good work. Thanks very much for that, Niall. We do get a few of those. I don't read them out for the most part because, you know, modesty forbids us. But it is lovely to get those emails, and we do appreciate them receiving them, even though we may not always read them out. Not a huge amount more, some random texts as we normally get, but if you do have any comments on the program, would like to suggest a feature, or would like to hear my take on anything, all we've got is time, right? You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. That's it from us for this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing, researching, Simon Keane, and on sound, Peter Malloy. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed over the coming week. In the meantime, stay curious.